This episode is brought to you by the International Game Developers Association, a nonprofit group promoting and advocating for game developers worldwide. Join today at igda.org and use the code IGDA4thCurtain15 for 15% off your membership.
I immediately looked at game developers as artists, you know, like a collection of different weirdos with different skills, but they were definitely, like, they certainly weren't business people. You know, and they were, at the time, people weren't really looking at video game developers that way. They were looking at them more like toy makers. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure these guys are new entertainment artists. And what if we just skip the part where they just get taken advantage of for several decades, you know, because they're not business people. And just fast forward to the part where people realize that the artists are the most important part of the industry.
That was Mike Wilson talking about how he views game developers as artists, which today's world, I think, not terribly surprising. But back in the 90s, that was a kind of a unique point of view.
Yeah, it's the customer is always right in a matter of taste, you know, that kind of thing. Have you heard that? People use it differently now, right? Like, the customer's always right. They think that, like, you have to listen to the customer, but that's not what it means. It means that, like, the customer's going to buy something, because, you know, a lot of the developers on his label are people that are artists that are inspired by other art, and they're making stuff for the customer and themselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's like beauty's in the eye of the beholder,
I guess.
Right? Yeah. It's like, it's art if somebody thinks it's art.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mike came up with that point of view, which I think was a fairly unique point of view at the time, like just the way the software business works.
It still is, right?
Yeah, I guess. What I was going to say is he built his whole career around that. And every step that he took, you know, he was at id. He started his own publishing label. He did that again. He did it again with Devolver. He calls himself very lucky, but obviously it is a point of view that he has honed and doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on.
Yeah.
And good for him. I think that's awesome.
Good for him. Yeah, there is really, like, only one Devolver. There isn't another publisher like that I can think of. Like, after we got off the call, I tried to think about it. I'm like, there really isn't another publisher that does it that way, you know, that I can think of. There isn't, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you could self-publish, I guess, but it's like a nice label. You want cool games, interesting, unique. The customer's always right in a matter of taste.
That's right.
I was just thinking about that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't know that second part of that line. I never heard that before.
Would you look it up? You Google that? Where?
No, that's TikTok knowledge. That's where I get all my wisdom from.
Oh, God.
Most of my wisdom.
All right. What do you got going on this weekend? Anything good? It's still raining here. People, listeners, how many episodes in a row has it been raining?
And it never rains in California. Is it El Nino out there right now?
Apparently, there's so much snow in the mountains here that the roads are closed.
Oh, like, really?
If you're an elite in Tahoe, you're probably stuck there. So, I don't know. Maybe you're going to get eaten by a bear.
No, that's not good. I love that about California, by the way.
That there's mountains and there's beach and there's desert.
Yeah, and you could do it all in the same weekend, same day.
Did you ever do that? I never did that.
I drove one day to the mountains of snow and then drove back, and I think we got close to the beach, and that's when I realized that. It's like, wow.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Being from Chicago, I have often turned around to the family and said, hey, who wants to drive up to the mountain and go sledding this weekend? Crickets. Zero takers.
It is kind of a drag.
Yeah. No one. In fairness, that's kind of the response to a lot of my initiatives around the house.
You got too many cozy things, man. Make your house uncozy. Make it just like a really crappy place to be. Like, let's get out of here. Yeah. So wait, so it's raining, which it never does in LA. Does that mean that, like, when you go driving, people are just, like, do people not know how to drive in the rain there?
Well, 2 weekends ago, I went over to Pasadena, and it was raining like this. I was going down an expressway, and I passed two separate accidents, like spin-outs.
Yeah.
You know, because it doesn't rain a lot, so when it does rain, you know, all the oil that kind of, like, ends up on the road.
Yeah.
It comes up and it is actually kind of treacherous.
Kind of dangerous.
You wouldn't necessarily think that, but it's true. So be careful out there, everybody.
Are you excited about self-driving cars?
No, I'm not excited about self-driving cars. It's not a thing I ever really think about.
It's going to happen though, right?
Yeah, I'm sure eventually. When I do think about it, I mostly think about how it's a complete sham and a lie right now, and that it's just techno bullshit that big companies, not big companies.
Oh, to sit, to make money.
Yeah, that people have been selling to like make their stock go. It's like, yeah. Come on, you freaking break. It's not really.
It's not going to happen.
I don't know. Maybe it's closer than I think, but like I have a car with
a Tesla
self-driving capability and I would not freaking trust it.
You have two, right? Two self-driving.
I guess they all have some sort of something, but yeah.
Does the truck have self-driving?
Not, no. I mean, it has like the basic.
The Tesla does though,
it's
right?
It's got like fancy cruise control. But you know, we're really going to sit around talking about my cars. I mean.
Well, no. Hold on. No, there's a point here. So I think when they do become a thing, if they do, there's two points here. The first one is if they ever do become a thing, you're going to see a whole like video game subculture within the car, like party games that families can play together, things like this. I bet you that's going to happen.
I saw an ad for one.
For Tesla?
It may have been a thing that you do on your phone when you're driving, but it was an ad for the first game designed to be played on the road while you're driving.
On the road. Okay. Yeah. So there's that. And then the other thing is, you reminded me of, I'm not going to say the studio, but since we're talking to a publisher today, and you said that the whole self-driving thing was a sham, I have a story for you. Two story. So this is I worked at a studio where the publisher, how do I say this? Okay, first of all, the developer would tell the publisher, they would promise things like 200 people online. This is before 200 people online was a thing, before it was even possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they were promising that kind of stuff. And it only ended up being 32 people. You know how it is, right? So they were mm-hmm. getting all this, mm-hmm. right? So they overpromise, underdeliver. And then and I wasn't here for this. So this is a story that my coworkers told me. I think I actually went to go work with you at the time. And just as I left, oh no, then people can go back and look. That's probably not true. But they were working with a publisher and they told the publisher they were making two games. You know how some studios would do that? They would make two games. They would make their own game and then they would make the game for the publisher. And sometimes they would share. Mm-hmm. They would share people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen, you know, studios have done this. I'm sure this is a thing. But, and I don't even know if I should.
That's not uncommon for studios to try to be smart about utilizing their staff efficiently across multiple projects.
Alex is a pro. Yeah. So they made the people change their clothes. Like they like to show like.
Oh.
So the publisher came by and everyone was sitting at their desks.
So their intent was to be deceiving. That's not cool.
Yeah. Anyways, you just reminded me of that. I don't know why I'm telling that story, but.
I don't know why either, but it's funny.
I just thought that was weird. Like the kind of stuff developers do, the publisher-developer relationship is...
That's a lot of that's just motivated out of fear. You know, you get a gig and you want to keep it, or you don't have a gig, you want to get it. And you think about what's going to happen in the worst case scenario, and you're afraid of that. And so you do whatever you can do to make sure that
keeps going.
Fearful thing doesn't happen.
That's fair.
It's kind of like fundamental motivation of humans. Yeah. As expressed in the video game industry. All right. Well, thanks for joining us this week. We have Mike Wilson, who is a cool cat. He's also, I think, one of the more interesting and unique. He's got one of the more unique stories in the game industry. So hope you enjoy the conversation and we'll see you on the other side.
See ya.
All right, well, let's talk about keyboards. You know I love a good mechanical keyboard. I got a chance to go
for it. Hold on, no, stop. You were going to send me
what? One. What?
You were going to send me. That's how the conversation started. You thought.
Listen, if you want to get yourself a keyboard.
You could win one, right?
Yeah, you should be following the fourth curtain. You should be on our Discord because we're giving away a High Ground high-performance keyboard. These things are fantastic. Go visit highground.co. Check out what they've got going on over there. In fact,
and they sell out.
Discount code for you. They do. They do these drops. They sell out. They do have a section on their site for always available. And those are super cool too. Fourth Curtain 10, that's the code, gets you 10% off over at High Ground. They handed me this keyboard and I almost dropped it because it's so solid.
It's so heavy.
Yeah. Awesome. They're a great partner. Go head over to their website, use the discount code to get a 10% off. And we're giving one away too. So follow our Twitter at Fourth Curtain for details on how to win yourself a High Ground keyboard.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Fourth Curtain. Today we have an absolute gem of a guest with us, Mr. Mike Wilson. You may know Mike as the founder of Devolver Digital, but he's been in this business for, I think, as long as me, maybe even longer. But hey, Devolver, publisher of hits like Serious Sam, Hotline Miami, Cult of the Lamb, Fall Guys, over 100. I looked on the site. I had no idea Devolver has published over 100 games. That's bonkers.
Fall Guys was Devolver? I didn't know that. That's awesome.
It was for a minute when we launched it, and then Epic said, we would like that very much.
We were like,
we would like for you to have it very much.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But yes, if you go into the Wayback Machine, got to start, I believe this is right, at Dwango before getting an intro to its software, helping to run that studio, and then Ion Storm and Gathering of Developers. He's been a huge champion of game developers everywhere. I got a chance to work on a game with Mike back in, must have been in the early aughts. He's been a big supporter of mental health in the industry. We need more of that. Hey, Mike, great to see you. Welcome
Hello.
To the show.
Welcome to the show.
How's it going?
Yeah. Good to see you, Alex. It's been a minute.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a pretty decent recounting.
Was Dwango really your, was that your first exposure to the game industry?
Well, my first exposure, I was friends with Adrian Carmack, who was one of the original id guys. He was just like a pen and paper artist from, he was the best guy who could draw in our high school in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Oh, that's great. You guys went to high school together? That's crazy.
Yeah, Adrian and I did. And yeah, he was just that guy that everybody would ask to draw a thing if they needed it. But he had a $5 an hour internship with these guys that had assembled in Shreveport, Louisiana, to work on a game of the month for a little, maybe the first game or magazine that shipped with a disc every month. It was called Soft Disc.
Oh, yeah.
And they were literally making a game a month. And Adrian was their art intern, I guess. He was actually their only artist, too. They paid him like an intern. I would go over and play Dungeons and Dragons with these guys sometimes. They're all in a lake house in Shreveport, Louisiana. And then I kind of went off and was doing random entrepreneurial stuff, trying to support a surprise baby in my very young life. And I was just kind of keeping tabs on these guys. And eventually Adrian, my friend, called me and he's like, dude, I just got a raise. I'm making $23,000 a year. I was like, with those nerds? And he's like, yeah. Yeah, with those nerds. Like, I'm sculpting with Legos. I learned this one MS Paint program. And then the next call, he had just gotten a $50,000 bonus.
Wow.
This was after Wolfenstein shipped, I guess. And then the next call, he was buying a mansion. You know, and this was all in pretty rapid succession, mind you. This was like over the course of like a year, these differences. And I was just kind of their one of very few friends of theirs that did businessy stuff, you know? And so luckily when Dwango was this thing this kid in Houston invented to allow people to play Doom over the internet against each other, the deathmatch, not over the internet, direct to modems.
Like with a modem, right? This was back in early
90s? 94,
yeah. So some of our listeners are not as old as us, Mike. So just Dwango, like a modem, that was the thing that made the sound, right?
The
phone. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Because you couldn't play anything over the internet against each other back then, never mind an action game, like a really, really fast game. And so people had to dial up people, ideally in their area code, because long distance calls also used to be a thing, and people would run up $1,000 phone bills playing Doom against each other. Yeah. Anyway, when that thing started to happen and looked like it was going to work, and id was supporting them by giving them a free license to Doom, which was the killer app, luckily, they asked me if I would go work with those guys and see if I could help grow it, because honestly, it was a trust thing. They didn't know these guys. And this was like a small thing, and it was very focused on making Doom 2 and Quake at the time. And they couldn't deal with it. And I was one of the very few businessy people that they trusted because we played D&D in our underwear. You know?
Okay.
So that's how I got a look in the games industry. And they just suggested strongly to Duango that they hire their friend Mike. And they did.
What did you do there? What did they have you do?
We sold franchises to people, like by area code, because, you know, everybody needed a call that wasn't long distance for this to work. Mm. So it was a race to set up as many of these server racks in each densely populated area code in the United States that we could get to as fast as we could. And so somebody would buy area code 408, and we would go find a closet piece of real estate, like the cheapest real estate we could find that had enough copper running to it for the 32 or 64 phone lines. And then we would go to Home Depot and get a bookshelf, and then we would get like 32 or 64 of those 14-4 modems.
Oh, wow.
And set them all up and put them on a 486 server, and then a server to reboot that one when it went down inevitably. And then we would lock the door and leave and go to the next city.
What?
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
We set up 22 of those in 6 months around the United States. I guess it was impressed enough with that amount of hustle to make this happen that when they realized that they were getting a pretty bad deal from their publisher and they wanted to demonstrate that they didn't actually need a publisher, they hired me away from Duango 6 months later to do that for them.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Fast and furious.
Yeah.
That's great.
So, okay, hold on. So back in Shreveport when you were in high school,
yeah,
were you like techie at all? Was there computers in and around your house at all?
There were some computers. We had one computer class in high school where we made, you know, the most basic little programs in BASIC, but that was the extent. I had one friend who really knew how to program, and that was it. The rest of my life was very non-technical. I mean, I played some video games, you know, because I was alive. It was the 80s.
It's crazy. I remember using Duango. And then what was after that?
After Duango?
Yeah. What was after Duango?
Wasn't the internet?
Nothing.
After Duango?
What killed? Well, there was like GameSpy and stuff but.
Oh, GameSpy. That's right.
6 months after I joined id, one day Carmack came in my office and was like, hey, I just made Quake work over the internet and it's going to be free. You should probably tell your friends at Duango.
What? It's gonna be.
And then he just left. And I think those were the most words I have gotten from John Carmack in that first 6 months I was there. And I was like, but what? And so I had to call the guys at Duango. And by the way, Adrian and I now own three of these area code servers together. And so it wasn't great for us either. And I was just like, John says that your business is over. Yeah. He said, I was like, the good news is Quake is delayed, you know, and so you've got some time, but very soon people are not going to pay $1 or $2 an hour to play Doom over the internet or anything else. And of course, they were in too deep at this point. They were all in denial that this was going to kill their business. You know, like, oh, it'll never work. You know, like, how could you play a high speed action game with more than two players over the internet? Like, the internet was pretty chunky back then. Like, we were still waiting patiently for that one JPEG to open for a while back then. So it did seem impossible, except that John Carmack had said it. And he was not a guy given to hyperbole. Generally, if he said he figured something out, you could count on it being true.
What would you do if a server went down? Like, if one in Cleveland goes down?
We had a second 486 computer there to reboot it automatically.
Would they ever both go down? Like, was there ever any?
Yeah, there was a third. Okay. There was a 386 backup.
Nobody's there. It's just working on its own. That's amazing.
No, for real. And for a while, it was just this magic closet that we would lock up and leave, and it's just making cash. You know, all the time.
So cool.
Yeah. And the original one in Houston was literally, it seemed like we had stumbled upon unlimited infinite cash.
Yeah, that's the one I used.
Yeah, because everybody was so freaked out at just this basic ability to deathmatch without carrying a computer to somebody's house.
Yeah.
You know, it was a pretty big deal at the time, but we knew that $1,000 phone bills weren't going to work out for very long. So we had to hurry.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was crazy to me too, by the way, as a pretty decidedly not technical person, that we were just locking these computers up and it was just magically going to take care of itself somehow. But we did it. It worked.
Amazing.
Yeah, amazing. So, I mean, just one more kind of old-timey question. Did you have any, what did you think you were going to do? Like when you were in high school, what did you think your career was going to be? I'm kind of imagining you were not thinking, I'm going to be in the video game industry.
No, because it didn't seem, I wasn't aware that it really was a business that was possible to break into or what stage. I mean, I remember there were video games, but they were all made by big companies like Atari or, you know, Nintendo or whatever. And I was like, that may as well have been on Mars for me, from my standpoint as a Shreveporter. With not quite a Bachelor of Arts from LSU Shreveport. Yeah, no, I definitely, as a teenager, there was a time where I thought I wanted to be a video game designer, because I think every kid must have thought that. But if they had video games at home, like, wow, this is kind of the coolest thing ever. But it was so culturally not a thing, you know, that it just, I don't know, it didn't seem like an industry to me.
Yeah.
But I did. I must have thought I might work in entertainment, because I really was a student of the music industry. Like, this was back when music was taken so seriously. Like, we really revered the stars of the time in a ridiculous way. Looking back, but we took them very seriously, and they took themselves very seriously. And like, selling out was a bad thing. You know, it was like the worst thing you could say to somebody. Now it's the best thing.
Yeah, everybody's sold out. That's so true.
Yeah. So, but that, my fascination with that industry and my knowledge of how badly those artists had been taken advantage of completely informed my career in games, because my one friend in that business happened to be just an artist, right? Like, just a pen and paper artist. He wasn't a technical guy either. I immediately looked at game developers as artists, you know, like a collection of different weirdos with different skills, but they were definitely, like, they certainly weren't business people, you know, and they were, at the time, people weren't really looking at video game developers that way. They were looking at them more like toy makers, you know, so everybody imagined that if you're a game developer, it just meant you were a programmer and you were just making the new toys, basically. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure these guys are new entertainment artists. And what if we just skip the part where they just get taken advantage of for several decades, you know, because they're not business people, and just fast forward to the part where people realize that the artists are the most important part of the industry. And that if you're on the business side of things, like, I realized the publishers were playing the role of the record label. And to me, or a book label, it's like, all that anybody cares about is who's on your labels. Like, who are your artists?
Yes.
Nobody gives a shit about the label themselves. You know, nobody has a favorite book publisher or favorite film studio or record label. You know, maybe there are a few record labels that managed to matter on their own, but I just intuitively knew that at the end of the day, if you're in that business, all that matters is who's on the label and what artists and what, you know, records you put out, what games you put out. And thank goodness for that intuition, because that's the only reason I was able to have a career in this industry. But also not just a career, but like, me and my friends were able to actually make a difference for a fair amount of independent studios and independent artists that maybe also weren't considering themselves artists yet. You know, because artists, for most of us, just met somebody who makes art. So that's like, you know, my buddy Adrian, the interns, one job on the team. And nobody, I don't think people really thought of programmers as artists, or maybe even sound designers or game designer as an artist, which is funny to think about now. But back then, your younger listeners will just have to trust me that when I would throw around the word artist, people were like, what do you mean? You mean the people making the games? I'm like, yeah, the people making this new entertainment medium. And I was like, I'm pretty sure in a decade or two, everybody's going to realize that what's really important is what artists are on your label. you know? And so that was the whole point of my whole career, was skipping those painful decades of like early Motown, you know, where these artists would have number one hits and they're being carted around in limos. And then, you know, a year later, they realize they don't own any of their songs or even their stage name and they're broke. You know, I was like, can we just skip that?
Right.
And the answer was no. The answer was no. We could skip that, but most of the industry definitely did not skip that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, through my relationship with you, I absolutely 100% see that. How common, I haven't seen that POV throughout our industry. How common or uncommon, like from your perspective, when you say those kinds of things to other people in the industry, do you? You kind of already said sometimes people are, like, give you a funny look. Like, what do you mean? But has it changed? You know, like you have a whole arc now. Like now, like when you look back, do you feel like other people besides you share that opinion?
Yeah. I mean, look, I remember the first time I met Trip Hawkins, you know, he really dressed me down. He's like, I'll tell you about, you know, how to treat artists in this industry. Like he invented it, you know, and Electronic Arts was called that. Because they did see these guys as artists, but they also were on the side of taking advantage of them as quickly as possible. So I felt like they were using the word arts as more of a platitude to make these guys feel good while they took advantage of them. And I was like, well, that's not exactly what I'm trying to do, Trip. It was like, but I'll never forget it. I think he still doesn't like me. Like But I'll never forget being dressed down by Trip Hawkins and told that EA invented treating artists well in our industry. I was like, that is not the feedback I'm getting right now. But now at this point in the industry, yes, I think, you know, now that we've got our own fancy awards show that way more people watch than the Oscars or the Grammys, and more people know people in the industry, that I don't think I get a second look anymore when I call these people artists. And if I do, I can't wait for that conversation. It's usually followed with, did you know that the games industry has made more than the music industry and film industry combined for like 9 years now? Yeah. You know, and people are just like, I was like, yeah, they're artists, dude. They're entertainers. They're just not famous. Which is another really interesting wrinkle of our industry, that thank goodness it evolved that way, that unless you really are a student of the industry, most people that are gamers don't really know who made their games. You know, it's like some studio logo. It's not Alex Seropian, you know, or it's not just this one person that inevitably, when you have that type of fame, like you do in the other entertainment industry, it starts to attract people just for that reason, that just want to be famous, or it's about the ego. And the fact that our industry has never had that is this weird double-edged sword of, because there's power in that, right? It's, it's part of why developers have had a hard time establishing power in the industry, because they're largely unknown. And then it becomes even more just about the money. Right? It's just a business. If it's not individuals and personalities, it's just a studio name. I think in some ways it makes it easier to take advantage or be unscrupulous in the industry if it's not a person.
Yeah. Right.
So I don't know. But I've enjoyed the fact that we can, because I've also done some work in music and film, and I can tell you that the fame and ego part is not really additive to the experience.
I could imagine. All right. You talked a bit about being at id Software.
Yeah.
We didn't get to, let's keep going along the,
okay,
the journey.
Oh, yeah. We're way back there. This is a 6-part interview, right? How many sessions did I buy?
We got you on a payment plan. Even just being at id then must have been bonkers. Like that, you described Adrian telling you how, like, oh, I just got a bonus. Oh, I just bought a house.
It was nuts.
It kept, like, when you were actually there, it was still going, right? Still growing, Doom 2, and then Quake, etc.
Yeah, and it was a tiny team, you know? It was 5 dudes, you know? And their lives had not really changed at all. And what they cared about had not changed at all. other than they were driving much nicer cars to work and they didn't all share a work apartment anymore, that they, at least the one they lived in. At the time, they did all live in an apartment complex and had a work apartment in the same complex.
Really? I didn't know that. That's cool. That's a neat idea.
Well, before they all lived together, and you know, that's more challenging, but the, yeah, just sharing the same apartment complex as a team and just walking to the work apartment.
They had an apartment there.
Yeah. Don't get any ideas, Aaron. It's
that's
not
a good idea. Have a kitchen, a fridge.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the fridge at the lake house in Shreveport where I first met them only had a keg in it. That was it. Which at that time, you know, I was LSU and Shreveport didn't have fraternities. So that was the closest thing I had been to a frat house. So I thought this was very exciting, you know, my, even though none of them were really big drinkers, I think it was just because they could.
Right.
Because they could only have a keg in the fridge. So they did. Anyway.
So I have a question about Id. What were you doing at Id?
So they hired me. I was there to prove that their publisher was raping them and that what they were doing was not very hard and that they should have been making way more money on Doom, all of which these guys sensed before I was there, but they just needed us to prove it. And there's no better way to blow away all the smokescreen of, oh, you guys don't understand how hard this is of what we do as a publisher and why we need to take, you know, 80% of the money or 90% of the money or whatever. And these guys already knew because they were working directly with the ad agency and the PR firm at Id, and basically everything but the actual manufacturing and distribution, they were had a direct relationship with the people doing it. And those people were not at the publisher. They were independent agencies. So these guys are smart enough. And look, Scott Miller from 3D Realms or Apogee paid for them to make Wolfenstein. And he was also a pretty early pioneer in what being a publisher means and how to self-publish and the whole shareware model and all that. So we all had a special window that most game developers did not have at that point of people just thinking through things like intellectual property ownership and the developers being on the front of the box instead of hidden in the fine print. Most developers were not. They were just so stoked to be making a game that they weren't even thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. So that part was just sheer luck for me that's where I landed at a incredibly successful studio that had just really demonstrated how big the game industry could be and also had the business savvy to be fighting these fights. You know, that the vast, vast majority of game developers had no idea that they even needed to be thinking about that. Yeah. You know, because it's much easier to just trust the smiling man in the suit that gave you the money to make the thing, right? And seems like a nice guy, right? It's much easier to just imagine that person is a nice guy and that everything's fine than to really look into what they're doing and find out where the bodies are hidden and the money's hidden and all that. So I was incredibly fortunate that that's where I landed. And I was incredibly fortunate that my incredibly limited education, part of it was a personal education that I'd given myself through music magazines and books, you know, and just like, wow, you know, just thank goodness I had that basic awareness or I would have just taken that job that was way better paying than anything else I was going to get anywhere. And I might have just been comfortable hanging out and got, you know, maybe make some tweaks to how much they were getting from their publisher, but not go into a holy war, which is what I ended up doing. You know, when I realized just how bad it was and that these guys had a better deal than most who were making hits at that time. And they were still a terrible deal, but it was way better than what most people had. Then I realized what I had to do. And then it was an opportunity as well. That was like, wow, nobody's being the good guy. On the business side, I see an opening. And thank goodness they weren't all good guys. And the opening was for me to be the terrible person because that might have taken that one too.
All right. Well, so that was the perfect opportunity for you to kind of get into a studio, learn sort of the business side of it. In a kind of like a best case scenario, it sounds like.
It was a best case scenario. And I knew what I knew going there was that my guys were pissed off and they were pretty sure they had been taken advantage of. And they had that special hurt that's also combined with embarrassment. you know, and they considered themselves pretty smart guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
That had just been bamboozled by some much less smart guys.
Okay.
So how do you rectify it? Is it contracts? Is it like...
Yeah, no, at that time, it was really just cutting through all the bullshit, all the lies of how hard it all was and why they needed this much money. And I was like, okay, so, I mean, it literally took me 2 days to figure out what the publishers were doing and who was doing it all, and that it was all for hire, and that there was no magic here at all. It was just some guys, like, I went to New York to meet with these guys. I was not impressed at all with either their knowledge of games or their opinions toward games or just their general intelligence. Like, I went up there scared to death to go do battle with some New York sharks with my little white trash ass from Louisiana. And I left those meetings with a swagger.
Because I was a snap.
Yeah, I was like... These guys are not that smart, man, and they're not even trying. It wasn't that I thought I was so smart, but I felt like I was smarter than them and that I just a little bit of effort, yeah. You know. With
what you just said, I think is a really interesting observation. Like, you're heading up to New York. I assume this is GT Interactive we're talking about.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're a little intimidated. You're like, you have these assumptions that, oh, these guys run this big public company. They've been publishing games forever. They're big. They're in New York. They must be like really good, you know, imposter syndrome, et cetera, all that. And you discovered that it wasn't true. And I think it's just a good story about how just because you think somebody is smart or doesn't mean they're smart. You know, I mean, just because somebody's like off in the tower, it doesn't mean that they're better than you.
Absolutely. And thank goodness that was one of my first lessons, because if id's publisher had been Activision at the time, or even EA or somebody, that imposter syndrome would have carried on a little bit longer, because these guys were more established and smarter. And, you know, but GT Interactive at the time had literally just stepped in shit. Like, their other two products were Richard Simmons' Deal-A-Meal CD-ROM and Fabio Screensaver. They had those two and they had Doom.
Oh, wow.
Hey, they had the triple crown right there.
Yeah. Fabio Screensaver.
I wish I was kidding.
That's the guy with the long hair, right?
That would. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like an Italian model or something. Most famous for a bird crashing into his face on a roller coaster, I think. It's a good video. Look it up. That was early internet stuff. Because these guys clearly had no prowess. Right. They didn't have a bunch of gold records on the wall, you know, but Ron Chamowitz, who was the CEO at the time, did totally give me the have a cigar experience, you know, and told me within the first 5 minutes that he had discovered Gloria Estefan when he was with CBS Records. And I was just like, it was reinforcing my guess already that these were just the same slimy fucking bastards that come swarming around every time there's a new breakthrough in art, you know, art meets commerce. And they're like, oh, I got these guys. We just did this, you know, in the music industry. That was who was in charge. And thank goodness they were not impressive, because I might have left there less fortified and feeling like I could deal with these guys. But I had already figured out what they were doing. And again, meeting them only reinforced that. But you're right, Alex. It's a huge, just regardless of your industry or your life path, realizing that everyone else is just faking it too, and that they're not, just because they're already in this high level position doesn't mean that they're smarter than you or they somehow inherently deserve that and you don't, right? Because you're not there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's big, just human development stuff.
Yes, exactly. At the very least, nobody's going to care more about you than you. Yeah. Most likely.
Yeah. Yeah. Or in my case, my friends, you know, it was like, I knew I was hired there to just unfuck them a little bit.
Yeah.
And when I realized the level to which they had been taken advantage of was way beyond what they even imagined. And then realizing that other people who were not lucky enough to be id Software in that moment, but were making games that were selling millions of copies for Microsoft and EA and Activision and all these, they had much worse deals. And so, yeah, I've given myself the nickname Lucky in the last few years. And it's not because I want anybody to call me that or that I expect people to. It's just because I want to never forget. I've worked hard like a lot of people, but I've also had a lot of luck. And a lot of it is just being in the right place at the right time. And that's really where it started, was being at id and the fact that their publisher was a fake publisher. They didn't own anything.
Right.
They were just hiring agencies to do everything. And I was like, I can hire the same agencies, you know?
Yeah. There you go. Though I think you give Karma a little too much credit, because you busted your ass at Duango and that impressed those guys to let you come on over, you know? So
yeah. I had the imposter syndrome was so strong. I'll tell you one last story and we'll move on. But the day that I started work at id, because I had put a Duango office right below theirs in the same building in Mesquite, Texas, to keep their relationship close. And plus they were my buddies, somebody to go to lunch with. And the day that I started at id, I had this intern at Duango, and I was like, look, I need you to teach me how to work email. And if you ever tell anybody that I just said that to you and that you had to teach me to work email, I promise you, you are absolutely dead. And I don't mean figuratively, like I will murder you. And I guess he believed me.
You heard it here first.
First time this story has ever come out right here, ladies and gentlemen.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, and I scared the shit out of this kid.
Please tell me that kid, that intern, grew up to become like, you know, Phil Spencer or something like that.
Yeah. I'm not sure what happened to him, but he actually was one of the first competitive gamers to make money.
Okay.
Yeah. In the super early days of that being a thing.
Okay. Like Thresh. We just had Thresh on the show.
It was like Thresh.
Yeah.
It was like Thresh. It wasn't quite at his level, but.
Okay. Cool. All right. So after id, was Ion Storm next?
Yeah. Okay. I was there for a year. Yeah. Because I had demonstrated that id was correct. They did not need a publisher and that we could self-publish with all the same wonderful agencies that they had hired. And then I was like, I had become aware that there were so many other hit-making studios that had it even worse. So my pitch was, okay, guys, I literally got them 3 times more money on Quake than they made on Doom. And I felt like there was maybe room for more. And I was like, we can use this example. We just give everybody the same deal because everybody thinks they're going to make a hit. And if they do, they should get rich, right? And they should own everything and whatever. And if they don't, then what is the point of all this? Anyway, all this sort of controlling things that didn't work out. And John Carmack was super impressed. Like I had gotten the highest number on their range of what they hoped that I would get GT in that renegotiation. And he was just like, I don't want to hire more people that are not game developers. Like we had exploded by that time to 13 people at id Software. So, and 3 of those were not game developers. So he didn't want any more of that. And I was just like, I knew too much at this point. So I was like, when Romero left there to go start a new thing, I was like, he always liked the idea, right? He thought big. He was not afraid of hiring more people to help other people publish. And so that's what I went to Ion Storm for. And I was the first person to ever quit id Software of my own volition. Like a fucking idiot, by the way, because I was 25, man, and I didn't have a college degree, and I was quitting a 6-figure job that had just given me a pretty big bonus, you know, in Quake Ship. But I saw the problem was much bigger than id's problem, and the only way to fix it was to go be a viable alternative on the publishing side. You can't just wag your finger and tell them they're bad. You have to go do it, right? And go, you know, my message to the publishing world and to developers was like, not that hard. Compared to game development, the publishing side, not that hard. Requires some money and some connections, but pretty easy overall in the scheme of the project. And yeah, that basic knowledge and being as unimpressive myself as the mentors of GT Interactive had been for me. I was like, I can inspire people too with my overall lack of intellect and impressiveness. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
when you say, hey, the publishing, compared to like making a game, publishing not that hard, I would say there's a different set of challenges over there. But it, has it gotten easier?
I was going to say, it's not easy. I can't do what he does.
Well, you know, Bungie was self-publishing and we were doing distribution. So, you know, we were dealing with inventory management and shit. I hated that part of the business.
Yeah. It was definitely harder when it was retail.
Yeah.
For sure.
Oh, it's easier.
But still not that hard. And honestly, I think it's just human nature. Whatever you already know how to do doesn't seem as hard as things that you don't know how to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure that, you know, a lot of people get in a game team and find that have the same experience I have of going, oh, these guys are not all smarter than me. You know, like these are just people that learned a different skill. So, yeah, I'm sure that there's been many a game developer with that same level of imposter syndrome go in to find out the same lesson that I found out.
Right. But, does it seem like it's easier now or different? I don't know. I have no idea. Like on the publishing side these days, it's like you don't necessarily have to manage inventory the same way, but it's just the landscape of how you get the word out and the messaging seems very different than it used to be.
Yeah, it is infinite competition. You know, because all the walls came down, all the gatekeepers are gone. We still need money. And the standing out from the crowd is way harder than it used to be, because it used to only be, you know, maybe 20 games coming out a year back when we were getting started. And now it's like, I stopped looking after I read the stat like 5 years ago that there were 1,000 games coming out a month or something.
Yeah, I think Steam alone, I think, has like 10,000 games a year or something.
And it's mobile now. It's
crazy.
Indie stuff on every
console. Yeah, so now I feel like it's way more about finding that magic that makes something stand out. Back then, it was just if you could get in the controlled gates, you know, like if there's only 20 games a year or 50 games a year or 100 games a year, if you're one of those with some money behind it, you're going to get some attention, right? Even not very good games would sell pretty well if they could get promoted well. And that is just not the case anymore, man. Like, although we also see, because anybody can be a game developer now, regardless if they have any technical skill, we see things that we would have never guessed would be a hit. Yep. You know,
yep.
Like Power Washing Simulator. I love that that's a hit.
Yeah.
I love it. Like that warms my heart so much, and that they will make Power Washing Simulator 18, you know, like Farm Simulator is the same. Like, I don't know these people, but I'm so glad they exist and that they're being served what they needed,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like skipping ahead a bit to Devolver, which is where this vision of just being the outwardly friendly publisher and being incredibly generous with royalties and control over everything and just all the things, all the same things from that I fought for at id Software were realized in Devolver in this new all digital indie wave, because it was suddenly back to small teams making really weird shit that lit the world on fire. Which, so for me, I had lived through this rush from little tiny id to everything wanting to get big. And I had experienced, as things moved in that direction, the less and less fun that anybody was having, you know, and whether it's being part of a 4-person team versus a 200-person team, and just the, am I actually contributing anything that matters feeling, to when the numbers get big, suddenly a lot of people that don't care about games at all are making big decisions, you know, like really important decisions. And for it to flip that, like I was out. I wanted out of games. And when I worked with you, we were at a company called Gamecock. And if you look back, it looks like I wanted out of games. I was like, fuck, I guess we'll do this, you know, but it sucked because it was right at the height of, it was still in that gold rush of everybody wanting to be big and be taken seriously, and this new wave that happened in the Devolver times of everybody going, oh, that was a terrible idea, the getting big and being taken seriously, that is no fun, and digital distribution becoming a thing was just this renaissance to me of these little tiny teams making really weird things that could find a niche somewhere in the world. You know, at Devolver, most of our stuff, almost nothing sold more than half in the United States. Everything was finding its home elsewhere. You know,
we're
a very globally oriented company.
Oh, that's super cool.
Yeah, it's another like the no personalities, no fame, no, I'm certainly not going to say no ego thing, but much less than other entertainment industries. The global nature of games is the other favorite thing for me because most people don't even know where a game came from.
Yeah.
Or where that studio logo,
right,
what that even means. How many people are there, where they're located, what culture informed them. And so even more than music, which is pretty global, games from far corners and cultures that we never really interact with can be successful in the States. Yeah. That doesn't really happen in film and music very much.
You're right. Did you guys publish any games that came out of, say, like Africa or?
Yeah. Well, South Africa.
Yeah. Okay.
My favorite developer I ever worked with. Sorry, Alex.
You're supposed to say present company accepted. That's the way you phrase it.
Yes. Yes. Other than people on this podcast, my favorite developers I ever worked with, it's a company called Free Lives out of South Africa, out of Cape Town. And they made several hits for Devolver, including Broforce.
Yeah.
Still maybe the best party game, like four-player co-op couch game ever, other than Hail to the Champ, which was more competitive.
Good pull.
And then they made Genital Jousting.
What? Oh, yes. I remember seeing that.
I've never seen that.
At your parking lot at E3. I remember that.
Man, you got to try it, Aaron. It's it was inspired by a perception of this team's, they felt like the game industry and gamers were pretty homophobic.
Okay.
And so they wanted to make the gayest game ever, but also so good that you wanted to play it. You know?
It's a good double.
And so they made an 8-player console game so that if you had 8 players and you had 4 controllers, people, usually dudes, had to share a controller to get a little closer, you know? And they were literally, you know, multicolored fallacies.
We'll look it up. We'll link the correct tense.
It's a party game.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Also, by the way, it was a party game. It was in early access for like 3 years. And then they decided to make a first, like a story mode. And it won like narrative, or it was nominated or won narrative of the year at GDC. I don't remember what. Oh my God. And you're playing like this middle-aged penis, smoking a cigarette and evaluating your life's choices. You know, getting nervous about going to a class reunion.
It's like you said, it's art. It's art.
It's art.
That is awesome. All right, we skipped over gathering of developers, which I think probably important because
yeah,
my recollection is the way you set that up, it had a very unique structure and the founding developers were equity holders. That's my recollection.
Yeah.
Is that how it was kind of set up?
Yeah, that was born at id, that business plan, and even the name GOD was born at while I was still at id. And that was basically what I pitched to the team. I was like, hey, you know, we could take this thing that we just figured out and offer it to a lot of other developers. And, you know, GT Interactive had gone public for $1 billion, which in 1995 was the biggest IPO in any industry that year. And they had done it just on Doom and not really a long-term relationship. Like the developer that made that game hated them and couldn't wait to leave, but they still did way better than, you know, my guys, don't get me wrong, my guys are buying Ferraris and mansions, but the amount of wealth that went in the direction of those guys versus the guys that actually created the thing was so out of proportion. So I was just like, at the time, and still really, this is often the case, the biggest, most successful publishers only had one or two hits, franchises, you know, that they just fed and everything else was a miss. Like it was accepted that 9 out of 10 were going to be misses and you just had to milk every nickel out of the ones that hit to pay for those, which I hated that model, you know, but it's to pay for what Wall Street wanted game companies to look like to pay for thousands of employees, which is just nuts to me for the mechanics of what needs to happen. So it's like building your company around what this idea of it should be, according to these guys from different industries, instead of the way that it actually works well, which is, in my opinion, small, lean, you know, efficient And anyway, I pitched it. Carmack didn't want to hire the people to build Gathering of Developers. Romero was into it. Ion Storm was supposed to be one of the original founding developers. And then, you know, it became apparent pretty soon that they were not going to deliver the games to their first publisher anytime soon. And so I was like, this was my thing, right? I was not a game developer, so this was something I was in a hurry to get to. Mm-hmm. I saw this opportunity. It was a huge business opportunity, but it was also like, and we get to be the good guys? Are you kidding? Like, let's go. And I was, you know, I was 25. I'd quit it like an idiot. I was called the CEO of Ion Storm, but I had no real control there. And then I meant to be there for a year before we could set up God Games. And it became apparent that wasn't going to be the case there. And so I was the loud guy complaining that no games were being made. And I got escorted out of Ion Storm, basically. I was like, you are bumming us out with all your talk of how no games are being made, you know? And that was hard for sure, but it was the kick I needed to get God Games started without Ion Storm. Because the idea was there. I already had all these other developers that had made hits that wanted in. They were just waiting for Ion Storm to do something. And so it all worked out as it should. And I was able to start, because again, with the basic idea that what is the value of a publisher? It's who's on the label, right? So right. If we can get 5 or 6 hit makers instead of the 1 or 2 that the biggest guys have, what a great label that is, you know? And if you're not a public company and you don't have to hire 1,000 people because that's the way you're supposed to look, man, how much money is there to be made? And how much can we help the artist side of this industry by proving there's another way? And so rather than ask these independent studios to merge into a conglomerate, we just created a new company and gave them all a piece of it for their commitment of their next games, you know? Right. And it certainly wasn't without risk, you know, like these guys were leaving Activision, Microsoft, GT, EA, and there were repercussions. When we announced the company and that these studios were all involved, like all of these guys got very hard phone calls from their existing publishers because we were there to tear down the curtain and show the men behind the curtain we're not doing very much, you know. And even before we got any funding, but we had a lot of press attention, we put out what knowledge I had gleaned of what was possible and what was a fair deal still for the publisher to make good money on their investment. And we put that out on the internet, like the 10 commandments of a good deal. Yeah.
Remember that.
And people have hit me up all throughout my career and told me that they saved that on their computer, like back then, or like it still exists somewhere.
We should post it. I've never seen it.
I will look it up.
Not everything on there is still applicable because it was in a retail era, but it was still more information than it ever existed on what a good deal should look like for this new industry, because one of the most insidious, terrible parts of the smiling men in suits was they would sign all the developers to a non-disclosure, and the developers, not being business people, would take this seriously. They wouldn't talk about their deals with one another because they thought they might be sued or they're just doing the wrong thing by breaking their agreement. And it was this terrible way to keep the information unavailable.
Right.
Of what other people's deals were. And they all told the developers the same thing. Like, look, guys, you're getting the very best deal that we've ever done. So please don't tell anybody else. And that's very effective.
It's so evil, man.
So evil, but you can understand as I say it how effective it would be, right? Because every developer wants to think that they're getting the very best deal because they have the very best game. And so it's such an easy sell. And so developers were just not talking to each other until I was, with my knowledge I had gained from id, going door to door, because a lot of those guys happened to be in Texas at the time. And they were literally... like I remember right now, I have chills telling you the story about developers literally crying on the table in front of me, realizing that they should have been financially independent, like easily. They should have had Ferraris and mansions and whatever. And because oftentimes their games at the time had sold even more than id's, but they didn't have any direct sales and they didn't have, like they had an even worse deal from bigger companies. And so they didn't own the IP. You know, yeah. it was early Motown.
Yeah.
And I watched grown men that were not particularly in touch with their emotions fucking cry in front of me. And, you know, part of me is like, this is a good idea. This is going to work. And the other part of me is like, I can't not do this because this is heartbreaking. Like this is knowing how hard it is, or having some knowledge from my friends about how hard it is to make a thing that lights the world on fire. And then still having to fight for your money after you do that, which should just be automatic. But again, I knew from my studies of other artists being taken advantage of that is just not the case most of the time, right?
Yeah. How did you guys, when you started gathering developers and you're getting your initial roster developers kind of on board, like where did you raise money from? Like to give, I'm assuming you were giving money to the developers.
Yeah. So I had them all sign a contract that said, if I raise $5 million by May 5th, 6 months from the time, you know, I asked them to sign this contract, then those contracts were effective and I was their publisher of their whatever they had committed. And if I didn't, they were off the hook and whatever money we had paid them was, you know, they were free to go to another publisher. We didn't own anything. And I was so ignorant, and I hired an Ivy League guy that I just was sure, because I was, you know, from Shreveport, Louisiana. If I hired an Ivy League guy for finance, it would just all take care of itself.
What could go
wrong? It did not. And instead, I ripped that $5 million check out of Ryan Brandt's hands at 4 a.m. on the last possible day. Ryan Brandt was a guy who started Take-Two Interactive, which at the time had no money and no roster of talent. Like, he was just forcing it to happen. And that $5 million check he gave me was more than their whole company was worth at the time. And I literally pried it out of his hands at 4 a.m. on the last day. And which happened to also be the first morning of E3 1998.
Wow.
So we had this booth that my guys were building. Luckily, it was in Atlanta that year, so we could build our own booth. And I walked back into that scene with my guys screwing shit together, holding this check for $5 million that made it real. And Ryan, rest in peace.
Yes.
Was still maybe the smartest guy I've ever dealt with as far as the sharks go. He was like smarter than everybody in the room. Everybody in whatever room it was knew it. But he was also a proper sociopath. And I say that with love. So he was using us and the excitement about us and the excitement about a developer-friendly model to establish them as a distributor, because they had no content.
That's right.
So he very wisely summoned that check from somewhere, and they ended up, it ended up being a massive business for them, Gathering of Developers, or The Gathering as they changed it to, as I didn't really realize until they tried to hire me back to run it. I saw the numbers. I'm like, whoa, we were way more successful than I thought. And it was largely because of one idea that I had as a guy that doesn't make games. I was like, wouldn't it be cool if guys that made games chose the games? All the pressure's off me. They get to feel like the smart guys. And by the way, they happen to be pretty smart guys, and they happen to know the game industry pretty well. And because I had realized the people that were making those decisions at other publishers were not people that understood games or cared about them at all. In fact, often had a disdain for video games and game developers. I was like, I'm pretty sure this is why they're 1 out of 10.
Yeah. Yep.
You know? And so by letting the game developers actually evaluate pitches from other developers, we were 8 out of 10, you know, and we established 8 1 million plus unit selling new franchises.
Oh, wow.
In 2 years.
That's amazing. That's like quite a hit rate. You couldn't do that deal today, right? Because the deal you did with Ryan, I'm assuming, is you let them distribute the box product into the stores and they took a little cut. And so they were advancing you money against that. And that's how you funded the initial development.
Yeah. But the problem is they were also, like all the developers they worked with, completely lying to us about how much it sold at retail and paying us roughly half of what it had sold and keeping us barefoot and pregnant, just like all the developers they were working with. No, for real. Like it. I'm sorry. That's a terrible, like a boomer expression. No. I'm solidly Gen X. I'm not a boomer, but they were just telling everybody that they owed them roughly half of what they actually owed them. And then if people sued them, they would pay them three quarters of what they owed them.
Okay. And this you discovered when you actually, they ended up buying Gathering, right? You ended up going to work.
Yeah, they hired me to come run it because Rockstar Games had happened and Grand Theft Auto 3 had happened. And so their attention was pretty solidly focused there. And quietly, this Gathering of Developers business they had bought had become a $400 million a year business with no one steering it. Like just the stuff we had already signed. And so I got to sit down with this guy I knew, Mark Berman, who was writing royalty checks. He was just like a lower mid-level employee that was in, and I just sat down with him when I was back up there. I was like, what's going on? How are you doing? And he's like, oh, I'm writing a royalty check right now for one of your games. And it was a game called Heavy Metal Fact 2, which we thought, because Take-Two had told us so, that it was a giant disaster. And I was like, that game made money? He was like, oh yeah, all of your games made money. Everything you guys did, which suddenly it made sense to me why these guys had hired me back at like baseball player money, because they thought I was some kind of magic that just, and it wasn't. It was actually just acknowledging that I am not the magic and that the guys who actually make games might know something about making games, you know? And that, in a nutshell, is the secret to my success. This going, it has nothing to do with me. Just putting other people in that position.
I think that's a pretty rare skill, Mike. It was like just being self-aware of what levers matter and not having the ego to feel like you got to have your hand on every lever and turn every lever, you know?
I mean, I will give myself credit for that because I have worked with a lot of people that have a much harder time saying it's not about me.
Yeah.
You know, like it's especially in business.
Most people.
Yeah. And in business, and especially working with creative industries, I feel like there's this, the creative guys are the cool kids, you know, which is funny because like the creative kids often experience the exact opposite of that in school and growing up or whatever. They were never the cool kids, which is why they spent so much time alone in their room that they get really great at this one thing that they do, you know. But in the business world, I was seeing this jealousy, you know, this like, and I think that's why business people, why they need it to be about them and about the business and their particular prowess, which honestly, business prowess, being a shrewd business person, is, in my opinion, not a compliment. Like, that means you're willing to do whatever. That means you're fucking gross. You're a used car salesman. Yeah, yeah. And it's, so it's a hard pitch to other business people to say, hey, we are trained monkeys. Like, we are lucky enough to work with these other people that have developed much deeper skills that the world is celebrating and wants, and we are selling shit, you know? It only works for a certain personality type. And luckily enough, I was able to assemble a team of people that felt the same way for Gathering, Gamecock, and Devolver was the best example of that. But all of it is that same mindset of like, it is not us who are important, and if we're successful, it's not because of us. It's because how we've treated the people who are the reason that we're successful.
Right. Yeah.
And that they love us and aren't looking to leave. That's the highest compliment that we could get, you know, for what we do, that we have taken away the grossness and the fear, you know, that they're being taken advantage of. Just always that feeling that you might have as a creative person dealing with your business life. There's always that, can I really trust Alex? You know, like, he seems like a nice enough guy, but so did that last guy, you know? And just to be able to remove that, and Aaron, you asked like 2 hours ago, I have no idea how long I've been talking, but to remove that contractually, because anybody can remove it in conversation, right? Which is usually how it's done. And then you get a contract that says something completely different. So for us, we're just like, always have leaned on the surprise of that contract that doesn't have any nasty shit in it. That is all written in English, you know, and like, or whatever the native language of the developer, yeah. And in a way that they don't need a team to evaluate how you're fucking up.
You know, actually, you're speaking the truth, because I've worked on 3 or 4 games that you published, and
Alex, actually, same thing. He's written contracts to me before in the past, and it was just like two sentences. Like, here's what you're getting paid. And I'm like, what? What do you, I don't know if you remember, like even the IT one. And then for you, I worked on Velvet Assassin.
Right on.
So I like, yeah. So, you know, Sasha and you know, like all the other, like the stuff with Alex too. So we, I had that vibe. Yeah. You could feel it in the, when you're making the game, it's in the studio.
Absolutely. And it's just that little easy surprise of not being an asshole, like not taking advantage of every angle that you could, because you know, something that they don't, you know. And that simple gift is really like a gift to me and my team, because everybody gets to work on the business side of games without feeling gross or like they're part of something gross. And that feeling also radiates to the developer relationships in the studios, because I don't know, like you can just kind of tell when somebody's hiding something from you or that they're not really in charge or if they're ashamed of something, you know, and their job is to go make you like them. It's not great for anybody involved in that relationship, because everybody's having to play some level of lie. Mm-hmm. And to remove that, just to go, we don't have to do any of that. I'm pretty sure that, yes, we could make 10% more or whatever on in any given project, but is that really better than having that artist dying to work with you again?
Yep,
no, right, it's not. Give them the extra 10%. Give them the extra 20%. Because if they're great and they want to work with you, and by the way, I also became aware early in my career that developers do talk to one another a little bit, especially, and to have other artists be your biggest champion as a business person is like, you're done. Like, you don't.
Yeah.
You know,
Twitter. And everybody says everything on Twitter now.
Yeah. Which is good, man. It's way better. Like, it's terrifying in some ways and sometimes unfair for sure. But compared to the days when no one was talking to one another and everybody was getting taken advantage of because of that fact, I love the new indie transparency, you know. And again, there are always problems. There are always people saying shit that is not always true. And, that, you know, bad actors taking advantage of whatever the paradigm is, you know.
Well, I think you're not the only one that feels that way, I think, because Devolver has been super successful. So
a lot of great games, too.
Yeah, the model works.
That, to me, it would be disingenuous to not say the name Nigel Lowry in that conversation, because in my mind, hiring that guy was like the best thing I ever did. He really cemented, he understood what I had been trying to do, what my team had been trying to do with God Games and Gamecock. And I hired him at Gamecock, and he just naturally, inherently got it better. You know, like I had nothing to teach this kid after like a month, and I couldn't wait to just get behind him and support him and go, that's your dream, right? As a business builder. But he, in my mind, is why Devolver did so well, because like we started to get into, while those gatekeepers and barriers are down, now it's infinite competition. So you really have to have somebody with exquisite taste that really is of the culture, you know, that is the customer also. Maybe not to quite fanboy levels, because that can distort your perceptions as well, yeah, as far as what will resonate with people. But Nigel was the difference between God Games got off to a good start. Gamecock was badly timed and badly informed in a lot of ways by like my particular attitude toward the industry at that time. And, you know, and then we all went through 2008 together, and that was rough. But the best thing that came out of that was hiring this guy, Nigel, who had written me a letter. He was at an ad agency in Dallas and wanted to get in the game industry so badly. And he saw what I was doing. He saw that I was sort of like trying to be the good guy while also lampooning the industry. And he saw how to do it better. He wrote us this letter when we were going to hire a marketing guy. And it ended with, I want this from the very bottom of my pee-pee. And I was like, well, I got to get the guy down for an interview. You know, either way. And he wanted more money than we wanted to pay. And after I met him, I was like, this guy's smarter than anybody I've talked to in a minute about this particular thing. And he does want it from the bottom of his pee-pee. And for all the right reasons, you know, like he wants it as a fan of the culture and the market. And he wants to help. Like he didn't want it because he needed to prove something to his dad or to be a rich guy or whatever it was.
Right.
And I was just, it's the best thing I ever did in this business was hire that guy. And
I love that your best decision was a people decision, you know, a person like.
Me too, man. It is truly my only skill that I will acknowledge for myself as I've got a good read on people generally. I've been fooled a few times, but for the most part, everything that's gone well for me in the industry has been identifying good people and treating them well. You know, like it sucks that that's a surprise for people. You know, to treat them well.
Yeah. It's a superpower. Maybe unfortunately, but it's a superpower. Mike, I could talk to you all day. I don't think I even got to my, I have a list of questions. I hardly even got to my list of questions, but we've kept you way over an hour. So we're definitely going to have you back for a second session at some
point. I would love to come back for a second session as long as, I mean, I don't know what you guys charge for overtime.
Yeah, it's not that much. You can handle it.
But like I barely could swing the subscription rate.
Well, the first 15 minutes were free.
Do you guys have a scholarship program or something that I could look into?
We should set one up. That's a good idea. We did do a Kickstarter, so, you know, maybe we could figure
something
out.
There you go.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for hanging out with us. What an awesome chat to hang out again after all this time. Great to see you. Congratulations on all the success.
Thank you. Now that I know you're in Los Angeles, we will share some physical space soon. And yes. Aaron, I'll be at South by Southwest you dare.
Interesting. That's
cool. I mean, for you, that's the closest thing.
It's the closest.
I look forward to learning more about people that I already know via your podcast.
Right on.
And thank you. Thank you, Gary, for having me.
That was awesome. That was awesome to catch up with Mike.
So interesting seeing him, because I've worked on so many of the games that he was the publisher of, and I never met him, not once.
Really? Yeah. Okay. All right.
Never met him, not once.
I'm glad you got a chance to meet him. It's great to see him.
Oh, not true. I met him once at the tent. I walked into...
Like E3?
Yeah, at an E3 party, and like, they had a, I think it was, what was before Gamecock?
Gathering of Developers.
Gathering of Developers, I think it was that one, or maybe it was Gamecock. They had some really big booth outside of E3, like in the parking lot.
So here's a story about Mike, which, by the way, so nice that Mike has found big success with Devolver. He has been championing developers for decades.
Yeah.
But funny story, many of you listening probably know E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, rest in peace.
No, it's going to come back, I believe.
I'll take that bet.
Slap bet. No.
But, you know, companies would get space at the LA Convention Center, Staples Convention Center, to show off their stuff, their games to the press and retail and all this.
Great
and
show.
It was expensive. Very expensive. Yeah. Like, we would do it at Budgie. We would get a booth, small booth, and we would always sort of ask ourselves, is this really worth it? And in the end, I think it was, because it's really about making those relationships. But in any case, Mike had his publishing operation, and he did not want to play the game the way the game was played by everybody else. So what did he do? He went across the street and rented an entire parking lot for probably like 10% of the cost of what you would have to spend inside the convention center. And he pulled up a bunch of Winnebagos as meeting rooms and set up his own outdoor party booth.
It was great.
That's just Mike for you. Yeah, it was a fun vibe.
It was.
It might have been a little bro, or a little, you know, a little too much party. I don't know.
Oh, I didn't see the bro part. I remember having fun at it. And I have pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I met him.
I think they were still doing that up through Devolver, because he was talking about, what was the genital jousting game? Is that what it was called?
Oh, the penis one or whatever?
Yeah, I remember seeing that at E3 outside in the parking lot, which is a funny thing to say on a podcast.
I get it. And I was like, oh, yeah. Fun time.
Another thing that I thought was pretty interesting out of that conversation, we probably paused the conversation to point it out to everybody, just how important it is to realize that there may not be a wizard behind that curtain. You know?
Oh, yeah. I think that's awesome that came up.
Or at least if you see something that you're like, I wish I could do that, you probably can.
It kind of came up during the Peter Molyneux thing. It's come up with like a lot, but we haven't really pointed it. Oh, maybe we have a few times. It's very human and it's within reach more than you think and understanding it. That I thought that was interesting. And also how casually he explained something that I can't do. I like laughed and the listeners can't see his face, but he just like looked like, what the heck is this guy freaking out? And, you know, he said, you know, you kind of know how to, I can't remember how he said it, but basically like it's with what you do, it's easy for you, but it's not easy for other people. And I think that's kind of important to point out. Like what you do, I can't, you know, and we kind of talk about that with other people. Like you can't do what I do or yet. Alex is making a face like, what?
I don't know. Maybe.
You know what I mean? Why do it all day? You know what I mean? Sit around and just eat candy.
I can move the slider on that color picker. I'd be like, oh, it's a little bit more.
I'm talking orange. About cracking jokes. But yeah, you know, and I think it's kind of interesting that he thinks what he's doing is easy because I don't think it is. I think it's actually very hard. And maybe he's just really good at it, just like you, you know, and like other people we know are really good at that one thing. And other things, sure. Like, you know.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I think if you've been doing something for years and years and years, you get better at it and get better at it. You learn more. You try stuff, experiment.
You chill. You're calm.
Yeah. And then it becomes, in your mind, it becomes easy.
Second nature.
But at the beginning of that journey, you don't really know how to do anything. And that's the part which I thought was really interesting in the conversation.
Oh, the email?
Well, at the beginning of his journey, Mike looked at what other folks were doing in sort of like what he wanted to do. And his assumption was there's got to be some magic there. And when he poked and he went and met those folks, realization fairly quickly was, oh, there's not really any magic there.
Yeah.
I think I could do this. And then did that and became a master of it over decades. So
that's the magic. And also when he's like, hey, you got to show me how to do email. If you ever tell anybody, I'll kill you.
That's good.
We almost picked that as the opening quote because that was imposter syndrome, I think, was an example of that too. So just, interesting all the way around. And it's nice to have somebody on. You know, we talked to folks who, a lot of the folks we talked to kind of were programmers or designers, you know, have been game directors and getting some perspective from folks who...
Artists.
Yeah, but, you know, Mike is a business and publishing and marketing and publisher, you know, and so, you know, he would look at most of the folks who have been on the show as artists, and he would look at himself as somebody who's championing them, and it's just a different perspective.
Yeah.
Nice to have that in the conversation. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us this week. It was great to have some time to catch up with Mike Wilson. I hope you enjoyed the conversation.
I did. Well, hold on. You can eat your snacks now, but I want everyone to know this is our second recording because the first one, I took Alex to conspiracy camp. And I was like, we should probably re-record this, right?
If you say that, then that people are going to want to hear it.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that as a bonus episode.
Tell you what, we'll post some outtakes from take one on our Discord. So if you,
we will? All right, let's do it. Alex was like, what the heck are you talking about?
I'll try and find some choice clips. All right. Well, thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Fourth Curtain Podcast. The Fourth Curtain is a production of Fourth Curtain Media with community management by Doug Zartman. Lovingly edited and mastered by Brian Hensley at Noise Floor Sound Solutions in Chicago. To get a peek at upcoming episodes or to send in questions to the show, visit our site at thefourthcurtain.com. And be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
Second take, baby.